imagine growing without the fear of being raped, without the fear of being harmed or hurt, or with just what would we be? What could we be? Who knows? I don't know.
Yeah.
But I'm seeing it happen.
Yeah.
Fingers crossed too. Fingers and the hands crossed. I'm seeing it happen.
We would like to acknowledge that we are on stolen Yuggera and Turrbal lands, and as settlers of colour, we reflect upon the damaging legacy of colonisation. Always was, always will be.
I am Shantae Link. I'm a Gurang Gurang, Cubby Cubby and Brisbane Black. I love creating safe spaces where women and children can enjoy life free of violence and harm. And that's what I'm passionate about, is us having safer communities. And that's what I like to be part of, creating safe spaces.
Right, right. And you mentioned Brisbane Black there. Is that a specific term in a way? Like, I think I've seen that associated with some music events. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think because my grandmother was brought down here when she was 6 years old, stolen, and brought down at the turn of the 19th century as into servitude. And we've been here for like seven generations now. So very involved in Brisbane community, traditional owners. I think we've married within and out of in-laws, outlaws with traditional owners. I've always kept space and presence within Brisbane. So that's why I consider myself a Brisbane Black, because I was born here, my mother was born here, my father was born here. I've children who were born here and grandchildren who have been born here.
Right, right. And can you, I'm aware that Cubby Cubby is more on what is also known as the Sunny Coast side. Yeah. Can you let me know where Gurung Gurung
That's country. Up near Gladstone and the Gladstone Bundaberg area.
Right.
Yeah, but so that's... Well, I think it's considered central Queensland coast.
Right, right. And so when you say your grandmother was brought down here, was it from those areas?
No,
too?
That was my paternal grandmother.
Uh-huh.
She, we believe, to be a Kukulangi woman. She was stolen when she was six, and my matriarchal line is the Cubby Cubby line. My grandmother was put into an orphanage when she was a young girl and down this way too. So both grandmothers were both basically black slaves.
Wow.
Yeah.
Right. And here, I think one or two prime ministers ago, we have some quotes like, oh, we've never had slavery in Australia. And here's a direct lifetime story.
Yeah. And I actually come from also South Sea for the blackbirding. The slaves that were brought over in up in the Bundaberg Gladstone area. So there's a long history of servitude and slavery within, or not as long as our history is, but since colonisation, definitely.
Right. Wow. I was just learning about the term and practice of blackbirding from an artist who was on Creator Tales recently, who has Torres Strait and Filipino heritage.
Dylan Mooney?
His name is Rudy Matoy.
Okay.
Yeah,
so that's, It's definitely not spoken about a lot in Australian history, the blackbirding, or actually any form of slavery. But it's definitely part of Australian history.
Was that spoken of by your elders and by your family as you were growing up, or was that something that you needed to look into?
Something I had to learn more about. The blackbirding was spoken about more openly. I think Australia feels more comfortable talking about that sort of slavery than the slavery of Aboriginal people. I don't know, because they're the other kind of black. And there's more comfort because they're able to position themselves a little bit away from that than it being direct, than the slavery that actually comes from here.
Right. So we like to think of this northern hemisphere and sort of outside Australia idea of slavery.
Yeah.
Right.
Oh, I think I could be wrong, but I just have this idea that's what it is. I don't like to... you don't see it mentioned very... I've never seen it actually written as such. You know, they use polite terms like put into servitude or domestic duties or, you know, them sort of terms that are used around what has happened here on this land.
Right, right. So if that was something that you needed to look into yourself, what were there any stories or hints? How was the stolen generation referred to by family members?
All I know is that my father was 70 plus years of age before he was able to walk back onto his mother's land. My grandmother never got to walk back on her country. When she was brought down here, she stayed in Brisbane. And I always remember many, many years ago when one of her countrymen came down to visit and spoke to her in language, and she replied to him in language. And I was surprised because I know she was taken when she was six, and that was the story within our family. She was taken when she was a young girl. And myself, one of my sisters and one of my cousins were under the veranda listening to her speak in language like she was so young. And at this stage, she would have been in her, I reckon, 70s. And for her to remember language, and then but she realised we were listening underneath. I would have been a 13-year-old girl, 13, 14. And we were told to get, you know, go away, not to listen. And even at that age, you still hold deep shame, you know, about identity. And it's sad because even before this trauma, though, I will say this about my grandmother. She was able to show incredible love. And she showed it to each and every one of her 29 grandchildren.
29?
Yeah. Yeah, wow. So that's, yeah, definitely. They couldn't flog that out of her.
Right.
The, you know, the ability to love, yeah.
Wow. Mm. And what was that language that she was?
Kwikalanji. She was, yeah, I'm assuming it was that was the language spoken. I could be wrong.
And what was your experience like growing up with language?
A very minimal language. Mm. A lot of Aboriginal English, black slang, but in some words that were used weren't used in around white fellas. But yeah, it was very minimal. As I've gotten older, thanks to my grand aunties, they've really tried to help reclaim language.
Mm.
Like by helping us name our children right way. The dictionary's been produced, and I got married recently in October last year, and one of my great aunties come and she got all the kids up dancing and singing in language. So there's definitely a revitalization happening, which I'm glad that I'm living to see.
Right.
And my grandkids are being actively participating in.
Right. Can you tell me more about the dictionary project?
Oh, that came out, I think, about 20 years ago. They fit our dictionary, growing dictionary. But even we were given the book. My mother was still alive when she gave me about 15 years ago. My mother gave me I've come from a family of 10, all of us got a copy of it, although that was the hardcore, still not really speaking it or knowing the, you know, intonations or how it's meant to be spoken. My old Johnson aunties, they've taught me a lot in regards to that.
Okay, right, right. And so you mentioned your grandmother came down 6 years old, stolen.
Yeah.
Which side of town is your family based on, or where are you living now?
I live in West End. We've always been inner city blacks. So
right.
Brisbane, Paddington. I was right around Paddington, Red Hill area. Really swish now, but when I was being brought up there, it was a poor area full of Aboriginal people and Greeks and I think, in Italians, yeah. So it was, I think at that time it was the poor, it would have been considered a lot more poorer. Now it's there, you look at Pato, it's that flash.
Right.
But it certainly wasn't when I was growing up.
Right, right.
I went to Pitcher Terrace State School and attended Calvin Grove High, which is now Calvin Grove College, which is now also another flash school.
Right.
But I got expelled from there, year 9.
What was that like, can you tell me?
I got expelled I got accused of stealing food from some Vietnamese ladies, girls, definitely didn't do it. And, it was hard slog going to Calvin Grove High. When I first because I come from a big black family that went through there. I'm one of the younger ones out of all my cousins.
Is it a private school?
I don't know what it is now.
Right.
But at the time, it was definitely a public high school. It's called Calvin Grove Secondary College now, but at that time, it wasn't. And I'm one of the younger ones, so there's 12, 8, 9, if a whole heap of us have gone through that school. And none of us, were treated very nicely because it's a big black family being pushed through there.
Were there others that were suspended, expelled?
Yeah.
Really?
One of my best friends, she got expelled too. And then during that time, I think it was if you got expelled from Queensland school, you couldn't attend a Queensland school. There's no options. So I got sent down to Mount Druid.
Oh, right.
Yeah, down in Mount Druid where they do it.
I grew up in St. Clair, next door.
Bidwell High I got sent to.
Western Sydney.
Yes. That was a culture shock. then eventually came back up here and went to Newmarket High.
So you did what years, 9, 10?
Yeah, down in Bidwell High. Then come back and did about 3 months in Newmarket and school wasn't for me.
Right. Yeah. Oh, that's interesting because I grew up West Sydney, Darra country, and then was living Yorra, Sydney side. And when you talk about, was it urban blacks? Was that the term that you used? Inner city blacks.
Yeah.
When you talk about inner city blacks, my closest reference, having not lived in Meanjin very long, would be Redfern.
Yeah, I lived in Redfern too.
Okay, have you spent time, do you feel is there some sort of similar feeling between?
I think so, in regards to so many different tribes and nations have come into the inner city, forced into here to help build the capital cities up, the free slave labour. So that means that a lot of displaced and dispossessed people, were put there to work. And I think that that identity, Redfern blacks are strong. I think Brisbane blacks are strong too. That identity is strong, but there's always that respect for the traditional owners. I think our stories of us keeping space in those areas, especially these high built areas, it's important.
Right.
It shows that we're still here.
Right.
We're the walking stories of Australian history. We are.
Absolutely.
Yeah. The black side of Australian history that's not discussed.
I recall recently that I think there might have been the celebration of maybe it was the 30th anniversary of the Redfern speech. Do you remember seeing that at the time? Did you feel
it's funny you should say that. Because you know there's that picture of Paul Keating, the little black boy?
Right. Okay. I don't know the specific one.
If you were to Google that,
okay.
There's a picture of Paul Keating after the speech and the little black boy whose hands he's shaking. That little black boy is my son.
Oh. Okay.
Yeah. So were you there? Yeah, we were there. Yeah, I lived in Redfern when I went to university in New South Wales. So I relocated down there and I went to UTS and my kids went to Redfern Public and I was involved in the Redfern community. I've worked in Redfern.
Okay.
Yeah, before I come back home to Brisbane.
Right.
Yeah.
And what years was that?
Oh, now you're really, we said 30-year anniversary, so that would have been 95.
Mid-90s.
98, yeah.
Okay, right.
You're right around that time, yeah, mid-90s.
And so here's your son held up with Paul Keating in this celebrated moment, this photo. What's your reflection on that moment and how was it for you at the time?
I remember sitting in the park and what are you saying? I think I was so naive too. It was so beautiful, the wording.
Yeah.
And I just felt so accurate and, this is really going to be the time that change happens.
Right.
But then I'm also a child of Brisbane. I was here for the 1984 Commonwealth Games and the marches and then I was down in Sydney for the 1988 marches and protests. And
okay.
So this was like, maybe. And I don't know.
So is that Commonwealth Games and the Expo 88?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so part of all those protests. and then thinking, I'm mother now, mulling out a little bit, maybe there is going to be change.
Maybe someone's listening.
Yeah, there was hope. that hope was quickly thwarted.
Yeah.
But yeah, for a moment, I mean, I cried when I just sat there and listened and just thought, oh, maybe they're actually getting it, you know, they're getting it. We're here. We're not going nowhere. Mm. The oldest living culture, actually something to be celebrated. Just maybe. But no. No. And here I am marching now for grandkids. Yeah, we're like down at the Stolenhof Games.
Yeah.
Yeah, the Gold Coast a couple of years back. And,
right.
And still in the streets of Brisbane participating in protests. Yeah.
So you mentioned a moment of hope. How long did that, or how quickly did that fade? Like,
by the time I caught the bus back down to Woolloomooloo.
Leaving the
caught the 3:11.
Right.
You're down
right.
to Woolloomooloo. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. So yeah. Then.
You saw the when you're boarding a bus because I was six children with a mob of kids. And after that was like, you know, it was an afternoon, peak hour, Sydney thing.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
You just look at the disdain of the commuters with me bustling on with all the kids. And then you sort of think, no, you're still in Australia.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Nothing's changed.
Right.
Yeah, it's honestly how fast it was.
White Australia still rules.
Yeah.
There might be a little bit of floral language here and there. But
yeah, those try to remind you who they think you are. But you've got to keep your memory, dig deeper and remember who you are.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Not let them be the one telling that story about you.
And you're still left waiting for action and not these words.
Mm. To, yeah.
Right. And then I think, would there be a growing amount of cynicism in which, fast forward to, I want to say about 2008, and who was the white male leader then who had something to say? There was the sorry speech by, who was it?
Kevin Rudd.
Yeah.
It was another emotional time because, you know, I come from stolen nanas and just if their stories were starting to be told a bit more openly too, actually, at this time.
Mm.
You get this little flutter. And I think that's what happens too within Australia. This is my own observation. There seems to be waves of pro-black, pro-Aboriginal. It's,
right.
People will try and approximate themselves closer to the people of the land. And then they soon move away from it again.
Mm.
But there was that little wave of goodwill and hope and, you know, some things may. But then as long as there's, that didn't last long either. I just can't remember. I keep trying to think, was it a bus ride or a train ride that shifted that one? I'm not sure.
Were you there for that as well?
No, that happened in Canberra, but I did have a cousin who went down for it.
Mm.
And she was very emotional because, you know, like we're grandchildren of slaves.
Mm.
And for her to go down and hear this and by this time our nan has voluntarily passed and, you know, our pops have passed and so a lot of emotion, holding a lot of emotion there and hope. And she was, she felt honoured to be able to participate. And I remember that yarn she was saying as she was going down. Two of my cousins went down, sister cousins went down and they were both pretty emotional about I think it might have been one of the organisations in Brisbane paying for their them to be able to go down. One of the homeless organisations were helping.
Right.
And they got down there and they were emotional and thing, whatever. And then they come back and just back to the stark reality of really what it is to be black and white Australia. Mm. Yeah. Right. Always having to push back through. Mm. But there's a lot of beauty in it too. I don't want it to sound like there is so much hardship, but there's so much beauty in being black and white Australia. You know, when you look at your own resilience, you look at your family, your bloodline, you look at, you know, the stories that we hold in strength and love, there may be hardship, but there's beauty as well. And there's learning, lots of learning.
Right. Mm. Yeah, if I think about Kevin Rudd and the sorry speech in that time, which I'm guessing is around 2008, the moment evaporated really quickly for me because I was down in Canberra, we were based out of a warehouse in Redfern at the time, just near the base of the Waterloo Towers there. And we were running a sustainable sound system company, and we would help out with protests and things like that. And I think in the lead up to the Rudd, sorry, apology, the apology for Stolen Generations was also the Little Children a Sacred report.
Yeah.
I know that's geared at towards the territory, which is not your country, but do you remember that at the time? Was that something that was on your
radar? I do remember it, but I really can't speak on it.
Yeah.
But I do know that out of it there was a lot of demonization of black men.
Right.
You know, around that. And I think our voices, and I think this is why I do what I do now, we're capable of articulating our voices ourselves without it being misconstrued for a white lens and the way that it's documented and passed around.
Mm.
I think I know that I come from a long line of very strong, articulate storytellers who are able to tell our own stories. We just don't need them to be silenced. We don't need them to be censored. And we need consent in the way that they want to share our stories too, and the way people share the story. Mm. All those things are important. But we're definitely capable of telling our stories our way, especially in regards to this, in regards to actually any sensitive area, to any area. I think it's just common decency to let people tell their own truths in the way that they tell them, and not be censored around they tell them, and not it be whitewashed in the way that it's told. And that would bring us to where we are today in regards to this thing of creating safe spaces where black voices, for me in particular, Aboriginal women's voices are valued and are important and need to be heard and listened to, and not just listened and heard to, but it's not just, they need to be able to hold their voices in decision making, decision making arenas, where they're not just telling their story, where people are trauma digging, but they're actually being able to tell their story and able to help make constructive changes into what we think community should be like and is like, and where we're building into the strengths of our own community, not not always working from the deficit. And that can only happen when we're being able to tell our own truths. That's my own opinion.
right.
Yeah.
I was very struck by, I'm always struck by Rachel Griffith's work in film, and the name of the SBS series is escaping me now, but it felt like a really important moment in truth telling. Something that I remember from growing up as a kid was seeing the first Australians series and just how profound that was, and I think it's perhaps similar to what you're describing, truth telling about first Australians by first Australians, and it was it felt so powerful and just felt like a rare voice at the time. Her new work was something on the Frontier Wars.
I know Bo Spearum does the Frontier Wars
podcast.
Yeah, I've listened to a few of those. It's just it's really deadly. I love it, and I've got my sons into listening to it too, because underneath this hammer of colonization, ourselves, we don't even know half of our stories.
Right,
they've been taken and fiend or they've been told back to us through a white lens. But hearing other black people telling our stories is so powerful. It's just and it's, to me, it makes sense. It's more meaningful and sort of thing. It's not I say thing a lot. It's important that it's not being censored. It's not being curated like a museum piece, but it's our living story, because we're still a living culture, living history, living, you know, we're here. And I think when it's told from that way, that we're still here, this is something that's happened, yeah, the repercussions of that is still reverberating, but we're still here. It's so important that we're not just eking and existing. We're here, we're living, we're thriving, we're, just like any other community, there's some hardships, some dark spots that need help, but we need to be able to have those control on how that happens too.
Yes.
How that's brought to light.
Yes.
How it's healed.
Right.
How it's, you know, how we move beyond it.
Yeah. Because when you have such white dominance in a society, in so many societies, it's not like when there's like one, Port Arthur. It's not like everyone goes, oh, well, what's the white community going to say about this now? What are they going to say about their wild man shit? No, he's like a lone wolf, or he's a bad apple or something. It's not the whole community, or we don't have like martial law in Tasmania and whilst they crack down on these shooters. It's down to the singular, right?
It's not
taken at that. At that community level, I did just remember the name of that series, the Australian Wars. So I think Rachel has really taken on Bo's work. And when you have this truth-telling projects, they can sort of work, lift up off of each other's work, and build upon that, kind of create the own library, because the libraries have been very specifically. Colonization has attempted to erase this knowledge, right?
Yeah. Even the, I think, Leo Persaud, the Drover's Wife.
Right.
The retelling of that from, like, this black lens, and it was hard, it was gruesome, it was hard to watch, but I loved the fact that it came from a black lens.
Right,
and
right.
Just the way that, it would make people just think a bit more about, this thing around identity, you know, I really, really enjoyed it. I enjoyed it. Yeah, it made me cringe at times, but I really enjoyed it. I enjoyed that rawness of that truth-telling.
Right, right.
You know, in the way that she, very, yeah, Leah herself so talented.
And can I ask about the cringing? Like, what was the cringe? Like, you just didn't like how some moments were done? Were they overdone? Or what kind of cringing was it?
Oh, the rape scenes. And that I think that's always going to be triggering no matter what movie, no matter who's... who's thinking it, but that's all part of the truth telling. You can't, you can't bypass it.
Definitely. I think before you mentioned strengthening black women's voices, I'm aware that a big project that you're involved in is called Breaking Silent Codes. Can you tell us about that?
It's a project that's been operating, I think, 4 or 5 years now. My time's not good. And it really started with my older sister Dixie and a Maori woman, Karen Heroini. They were always in these areas that were, you know, where we were being spoken about, especially around sexual assault and domestic violence, and we weren't actually part of the. We were the conversation piece, but not part of the conversation. So they really pushed to trying to make us have a more unified voice within the Eastern Coast and Pacifica. So we've had a few events where we've come together, one in Sydney, I think there's been one in Fiji, one in Papua New Guinea. We've had one up here in Brisbane of just women from these areas, sharing stories, sharing space, talking about things that are working within the community, our own community responses to the violence within community, what's working, what's not working, just having that space where we're actually being listened to, where we're listening to each other and learning from each other, like what might have worked down in Redfern might not work up here in Brisbane, or what's working over, like we went over to New Zealand, and looked at some of the things they were doing around their refuge scene. There's a whole big body of women who are involved in it. I'm just one of many. And I think all of us who are part of it are passionate about Indigenous women from whatever part we're from, having a voice, having a place within decision-making processes, having not just being the point of conversation, but actually participating in those conversations. I think all of us there are very passionate about us having our own solutions about safer communities and being able to voice that and being able to action it as well.
Right, right. And how long has this project been running now?
I think 4 years now.
4 years.
Yeah, so it's in New South Wales we recently just become incorporated.
Okay.
So that's where the hub is. We've got, I think, about 6 or 7 women from Breaking Silent Codes around up here in Queensland. Each of us are all involved in different things.
Mm.
So Breaking Silent Codes is more like the holder of the bigger network of Aboriginal and Pacifica women who are doing stuff within community.
Okay, right. And what has your experience been like trying to get a seat at the table for the last 4 years through that project? Or have you been making your own, setting up your own tables?
Yes, we've set up our own table up here in Brisbane.
Yeah.
Meanjin, we've got, there's a few of us who are involved at different levels and different things. Like we've got Sono Leone, she does strong women talking. We've got Sharon Malone, she does speak out. We've got Beck. Beck just started her own counselling service. All of us are just doing stuff that are around this, you know, and we rely on that sisterhood when we want extra support, you know, if we're doing something or advice on whatever it is that the other person might specialise in. It's a network where we can call on each other. It really is a proper sisterhood where we try and problem solve with each other in regards to, like, because there's always issues around funding, there's always issues around, safe space, always even getting space. Just try to problem solve with each other and looking after each other in an honourable way.
Right, right. And so in 2020 there was a certain opportunity for the group. What happened then?
We went to New York. Yeah, we actually got invited to the United Nations for the Corridor of Women to speak about Breaking Silent Codes.
Right.
And when we got over there...
what part of 2020? Because 2020 was a big year.
We were there the year the pandemic broke out.
What month?
February.
February.
We were there when it broke out, literally. I think we would have been one of the first planes coming back from New York to be quarantined.
Wow, okay.
Yeah, so it was, there were no Rona jabs or anything. It was just we went over there. And when we were in New York, the city was actually closing down around us. We went up Times Square and there's hardly anyone there.
Right. Like, how many of you in the group?
I think there was about 12 of us.
Oh, wow.
Who went over. Yes, it was a big contingency of us who went over. And as the days were progressing, things were just closing down around us. It was crazy. And then one morning we got a phone call and said that everyone has to leave New York who's not from here. And we said, it's about time we got home.
Right. And did you make it to the conference or what?
No. The United Nations, that corridor closed down that year. Okay. So we made it all the way to New York. We did a few smaller events where we were speaking about it, but we never made it to the United Nations, that year. Since actually, and we just come home, but we continue the work that we do. But that was that big splash in the Big Apple. Everyone was frightened that they're going to catch something, and I think we were there for about 10 days.
Okay.
And as the days progressed, you just seen the city go quieter and quieter. From when we first got there, was a bustle, and then it was crazy.
Wow, the slow shutdown of this buzzing hub.
So we were told that we had to leave, and we just, sounds like a good idea. Let's do it.
despite the UN side of the engagements not working out. What did it feel like as, to be there as a group, like 4 years or a couple of years down the track from when you start? Like, what did it feel like as a group?
It was an unreal experience. We got to talk to the Native American women there, and that was that was beautiful.
Right.
They.
I would imagine that might be more important to you than the UN. Okay, right.
Yeah.
So you got the highlight in.
Yeah, yeah, we got the good stuff in.
Yeah.
They actually, it was funny because they had already closed down their reserve that they were on. I'm so rude because I can't remember the name of the reserve from on that's on Long Island.
Hmm.
They were already shut down. So what they did, they sent up all this food over to us, and there was moose and all the traditional food. We were staying in Harlem, and then we had this magnificent feed, and not there we had them on iPads and thing, and we sat, and it was like one of the first cyber dinners I've ever had. It was
it was
crazy, yeah,
okay.
Yeah, because they had closed down early. The reserves like ours were over here, so that was good, and we got the Sikh hosted us down in Manhattan, and that was interesting. We did a big talk there in regards to what we were doing. We got to see some of the women's homeless shelters and the work they're doing over there, you know, DV around domestic violence. So it was still interesting. It was still good.
Okay.
Yeah, it was a big learning experience. It was lovely, actually. And to be abroad with so many different women, because there were women from New Zealand, Fiji, Cook Islands, here, you know, from here, Murray's inquiries, and we all travelled together as one, so that was nice.
All right. So First Nations women from around the
world? Yeah, that was all part of the Breaking Silent Codes. A big mob of us travelled together.
Right.
So that was, it was beautiful.
Right.
Yeah, it was nice.
Did you get a sense of how First Nations relations were in that country and how it integrates with the wider society, or say non-Indigenous people?
I think it's very similar to us. Colonisation leaves its ugly imprint wherever it goes. And, I think like us, trying to get back language, trying to land back, it's the same struggle. Just having a voice in our own communities is so hard. From what I could see, it's not, I mean, they've been under the yoke for 400 years. Us is 200. But very similar. Yeah, the colonial template, wherever it's used, it's harsh, it's cruel, you know, in regards to language, land, ceremony. It's very, very hard to template.
Yeah, such a systematic format that they got very good at, didn't they?
Yeah, very, very good at. By the time they got to us, they had almost perfected it. Well, they thought they perfected it, but no, we're still here.
Yeah.
We're still living, we're still kicking, we can still say we're the oldest living culture. Might have took a lot, but you haven't taken that.
Mm. Right. So there's another more local project that I'm still learning the pronunciation on, but I believe it's a Yarjan Yarawangu.
Yeah.
Can you tell me about that project?
We're a group of women come out of two women, Sharon Malone and Uraine Renoff. Sharon is also part of Breaking Silent Codes. They it actually means speak beautiful talk, and they both were workers for Brisbane Rape Incest Centre.
Mm-hmm.
And they started. It started off as an 8-week art project, where Aboriginal women were just coming together to talk about this, these subjects and creating some art. And at the end of it, we had an exhibition. And I got invited on as Nati to be involved with the women who were coming through, and just to participate in the program itself. So I went and. Now, I think it's almost 80 months later, after that 8-week program left, we pushed and for us to be able to keep the space. It was the only black space that I'd known of that was happening in inner city Brisbane that was talking about sexual assault and domestic violence.
Right.
That was being run totally by Aboriginal women. Brisbane was supplying space and resources.
Mm.
But other than that, they really didn't have a lot to a lot of input into things. Only input they had was that it was an 8-week program that they had attained funding for. And they were really responsive when we said that 8 weeks isn't enough.
Oh, right.
You know, this is something that's gotten bigger than what I think they ever thought it was going to be. We're still there.
Mm.
And we were able to, we're still able to keep the group going. Now we have, you know, paid facilitators who were there every Thursday. Women, you know, who aren't accessing our services are accessing the group in regards to getting court support, you know, just speaking about some of the trauma that this can often be the first step to their maybe referral to see a professional if they want to see a professional.
Mm.
We also do a lot of healing on country. We'll go take women up to a woman's site and do some of our own business up there with women who are, especially women who've just come out of court who are just verbalising what's happened to them and haven't, still trying to find that, well, some women who are still trying to find this, don't even know what they're going to do with it, don't even know what they're going to do with what's happened to them, whether they're going to put it through the, take it through the courts or not, or, you know, they're not even sure what their response is, some still numb. Just go up on country, sit and think and try and find a solution into, you know, what your next step is. What's the best step for the individual? And we've had a few camps now and we do it with like next to nothing. I mean, nothing. Mm. Women, they all know the go. Everyone's got to throw in, help each other for petrol or give each other a lift up, throw in for food. We've been very lucky. Nanjina has been very kind to us. It's a woman's space in regards to charging us very little fee to be able to sit up there. We've been blessed with that, that there's, it's bigger than just this group of women in Brisbane. We've had other women who have been just been very kind and thing in regards to helping resource what we do. And the stuff that we do are just, it really is women who are falling between the gaps, who don't feel comfortable using the services that are set up for them, yet they just don't want to use those services. And that can be something as simple as getting some petrol money to go to court so they can actually appear.
Mm.
And just getting transported to court and having someone sitting beside you. If we've done, you know, we do things like that constantly, and we do that with next to nothing. I mean, often it comes out of our own pockets to get women, if that's what they want to do. Some women just actually want to go sit up in the bush and go swim in our healing water. To be able to do that, that actually costs money and time.
Mm.
And just giving them that space to be able to do that. And, putting on a couple of feeds so that while they're up there, they're comfortable and being fed, helping to get them there. Unfortunately, with sexual assault, especially when it's happening from within the family, it often tears the fabric of family. So we have a lot of women who, because they've spoken, you know, speaking honestly and openly about their experience, they could at times be ousted from family or not supported from family. So they've got to look for other women's other sisters who are going to help hold them during this trial. That doesn't mean it's going to be like that forever with their family. They may, you know, people will take sides and think whatever, they might find a space back in there. But whilst they're going through that hardship of talking and they're refusing to sit at the same table as the man who rapes her, she needs to be, you know, to be held strong and securely. And that's what we try to do until she's able to find, you know. And often because of the trauma that a lot of these women have been through, they're able to support each other during that whole process. And then it goes beyond the group. It goes back into community then. We're creating networks within community where women are looking after each other the way we're meant to, the way we've done since first sunrise. And we're doing it in a way that's, I don't know, I don't think it's rocket science. I think it's the way it's meant to be.
Mm.
You know, and the more women who are talking more openly about sexual assault and domestic violence, it makes it easier for the next ones coming through who still carry that shame and that yuckiness about it. And when they see that this strong network of women who are existing and looking after each other and thinking, and they know that there is a way forward. And healing is not linear. It's hard. It's difficult. You can go deadly and really good for a few weeks, few months, even a few years.
Mm.
And it can take something shitty and horrible to trigger you to send you back. But as long as we know that we can also get up and move again from that, you know, that's all right. We fall down, we get back up. And there's women there who are willing to help hold you back up. And that's what I'm hoping that we're part of. And that's really, 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 I've got that commitment to community and women that I want to be part of it. I am part of it. And it's not an easy circle to hold when you're resource poor.
Mm.
It's not an easy circle to hold when yourself can sometimes be triggered because of your own trauma. It's not an easy circle to hold because you're tired and you're aging. You might be aging out. And it's not an easy circle to hold, but it's an important one. And that is what this Yadigal Wangru does, you know. And because of this group, it's in its uniqueness. Like, we've got our oldest participant, 78, and a baby. We've got babies who've been born to the group. So across the ages, from, you know, we've got a whole group, a little cluster of teenagers, and we've got women in their 30s and 40s. The uniqueness of that too, that this generational stuff that's happening. And I think this, to me, is a perfect, perfect response to intergenerational trauma.
Mm.
When we have so many women coming through at all these different ages, different stages, just really looking after each other, loving each other and trying to be as kind as we possibly can. And we're not all perfect. And we're not always able to do all that, but at least try. I think it could be a little bit of a response to how we're changing it up for the next generation. And we've got all these little girls who are like 8 and 9 who are seeing the sisterhood, the strength, you know, of women. Really, not that gossiping, the myths about women, the horrible myths about women, but really looking at the strengths and the beauty of women and the kindness and, you know, the nurturing, the stuff that and who we are and embodies us, especially as Aboriginal women, you know. Land care is looking after the land. When we go up, we look after country, we look after each other, you know, that sort of stuff, really putting that into our babies. And like when I go, I often go with my, when I go up to country, I often take my granddaughter with me so she can see it firsthand how it looks like and how it's meant to be, how it feels like and how it's meant to be. And for us not to buy into these white lies about the drudgery of being an Aboriginal woman. I want my granddaughter to see the beauty and the strength of being an Aboriginal woman, what it means to be a, you know, Kabi Kabi Gurang Gurang Brisbane black woman. What does it mean?
Mm.
And we have those conversations too. And we have them with these little groups of girls. And it's funny too because it's this generation of girls who are assertive and sassy and got big mouths and big noses. And I love it.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, you know, this another emergence, another wave of strength that's coming, but it's not coming out of trauma. It's being the seeds that we've buried in them are seeds of love and strength and beauty and capability and responsibility and obligation and all that stuff that goes with who they are. And it's not because it's been embedded in trauma. It's been embedded in something a lot more powerful than that, their growth. That might be the generation.
Mm.
Wow. I live to see it. My granddaughter grow into the woman that's never harmed. That's all I want.
Is this why? Is this why you do? Why you do it?
Yes. Yeah. For my granddaughter and my sister's granddaughters and my, you know, there's so many of us who've been harmed and fiend and it's changed who we were meant to be.
Mm.
Mm. Imagine a world where people get to grow. Just out of love, and without having to be, you know, imagine growing without the fear of being raped, without the fear of being harmed or hurt, or with just, what would we be? What could we be? Who knows? I don't know.
Yeah.
But I'm seeing it happen.
Yeah, yeah.
Fingers crossed too. Fingers and the hands crossed. I'm seeing it happen. Mm.
Is this like a lifelong piece of work for you? Do you think even before you were officially doing it with groups and titles, did you see yourself doing this throughout?
I was born into a family of 9 girls.
Okay.
Nine I'm the sixth. He's three younger than me. Yeah, three younger than me and six older than me. No, five older. Oh my goodness! There's nine girls and one brother.
Becomes hard to keep track.
Yeah. We're 10 in our family, but wow. I think I was born into a sisterhood. Obviously, with that them numbers, and my first cousins. There's 12 of them, and there were 8 girls and 4. And that's the closest of the cousins that I'm with.
Right.
So always women around.
Yeah.
Always, and always girl talk. Always, and some of it wasn't healthy. Some of it wasn't good. And some of these things we've had to relearn about what it means to be a woman.
Right.
But I think that I was always knew I was going to be, always knew I was a sister. Definitely, I knew that I also always knew the strength in us being together. So, I think I was born into a sisterhood that may not have been, may not have held strong over the years because of, trauma that's happened, but I've been able to find and help be part of a sisterhood that I want to be part of.
Right. Did you grow up with strong matriarchs?
Yes, I'd say that with my grandmother, both grandmothers.
Right.
They definitely held space and authority within family.
Right.
Yeah.
And so all this work that you've been doing seems like it's progressing each year. And this year it's leading up to another North American trip.
Yes. Yeah, we've got 4 of us from here who want to go over to Healing Our Spirit World Gathering over in Vancouver.
Uh-huh.
And I attended one of these gatherings in Sydney 4 years ago.
Okay.
It happens every 4 years.
Yep.
And it was eye-opening. I think that's when you start seeing, the colonial template, how it played out in so many different countries. You see it firsthand. You see people's responses and the pushback and resilience and the creativity in regards to our own healing and what it can look like and what has been lost and what's been refound and what's we've had to change up a bit. And it's important that we get to see these other stories because it helps inspire, I think, and helps make us not feel so alone that, what's happened here in Australia, it isn't just here in Australia. There's a bigger story at play and we're just a few chapters in that book. And how we, how we're going to rewrite our chapters is going to be, hopefully a bit different. But going to something like this, I know myself personally, it helps to have that bigger picture, that bigger vision of what the way things can be. And it also helps, I think when you're trying to push back against government and you're trying to be creative in regards to how you pool your resources, there's a lot of creative people who attend and talk about that. They talk about their own governance, how it can look different. It's really, and just the different ways of their response to what's happened to their communities through, colonialism. It's important. To me, it's important anyway because I like looking at that bigger picture where we sit. And that's what we're hoping to go with a couple of younger ladies. There's going to be a lady older than me and then me. So I think three generations travelling together. And I know people say, well, why do you want to go? Why wouldn't I want to go? Why wouldn't I want to see what other people are doing because they're doing similar, in this hard field. I want to see what they're doing. I want to see their successes. I want to celebrate their successes too. And it's hard too because we're doing a lot of our fundraising. Like we've got our GoFundMe page.
Uh-huh.
And it's hard because I don't like really doing the GoFundMe stuff because I see so many Aboriginal families who use GoFundMe to pay for funerals and their sorry business stuff, that I think I'm competing against them for that dollar, and as such a resource poor community. So we're trying to be a bit more creative in the way we reach out away from our community to try and raise the funding.
Right, right.
We've been lucky. We've had our registrations are paid. So four of us have registered. We haven't got our airfare flights yet, but we had to get the early birds. We've been able to raise the money for that. It's not until September. We've still got a long way to go. We're selling earrings. Alira, one of our ladies who were going, participants.
Yeah.
She's part of Bring a Plate, that dance group.
Yeah, that's how I know
Alira. Yeah, yeah. So they're doing on Monday night, they're going to have their thing down at Goma.
Uh-huh.
And whatever they raise from that will go towards our trip.
Mm.
I'm going to have a garden party in August, which will be hosted by my beautiful friend from the drag community. And we're going to have like a game called Ahoy, similar to bingo.
Okay.
They're going to host that and, you know, raffles and whatever. I think it should be good. My tickets will be up soon for that. And during NAIDOC week, I'm going to have a black trivia night where it's just all black stories, you know, all black questions.
Right.
If you don't know,
yeah.
If you don't know about black fellas, you're not going to win. But come anyway, come and learn.
Yeah,
yeah. Yeah, it's an opportunity.
Educational entertainment. Yeah.
So,
excellent.
And what else we got? I think we're having a few weaving groups.
Uh-huh.
Sharon is arranging. So we've got all these little bits and pieces that we're hoping to help us get there. We're going to get there. I know we are. I've already seen it. I've already tasted the maple syrup. We're going. I don't know how, but I just know we are. And I just, when I have this belief, I know that it can happen. I really do believe that. Once I've got my head stuck in it, I just think, no, it's going to happen.
Yeah. Is this how a group of 12 women went to New York for Breaking Silence? Similar sort of ethos?
Yeah. That was it. I think originally it was four women were invited.
Oh, wow.
And then the biggest, this is what we're hoping that we are able to, if we're able to raise enough money, we'll invite other Aboriginal women to come too.
Mm.
Who would love it and learn. And, you know, people in our community who are doing stuff and just like, because this big event, it'll be people who are in universities or in government bodies or who are in, you know, the places that have money to send people to these international conferences.
Yes, okay.
So that's little scrappy group of Brisbane blacks, we want to go and we're registered and we're going to be there. And, you know, and we're going to go there for the power of the people. That's and selling earrings. Earrings and hopefully T-shirts. We need to sell 400 earrings apparently. So if any people are interested in woven earrings.
Is it like the one that you're wearing?
Yeah, the ones that I'm wearing. Right. They're hand woven from women from the group. From our, So we're down West End Markets every Saturday.
Mm-hmm.
Just a little card table, little spot near Jenny Pineapple. We set up there. And
Right.
And some of the ladies are going to go to Bunya, I think out to the Bunya Festival this weekend and try and sell some out there too. 400 earrings, it's not that big if we break it down, we're thinking.
Wow. That'll get you halfway across the world.
Yeah. Yeah, it's going to. Watch. Next time you say, come back, Arnie, I'm like, how'd you go at Canada? I'm like, yeah, of course I will. I'll tell you.
Excellent. It's almost like I can imagine there was a period decades and centuries ago where the European colonists were sort of looking at how each other did colonization and copied each other and used their strategies. And I don't know if they met up in some sort of central way to compare tactics, but it's almost like I can imagine this kind of gathering being something like that of colonized peoples from around the world coming to talk strategy on decolonization.
Yeah, and how you've
been dismantling it.
Yeah. Yeah, it does. And how, what our pushback looks like.
Right, yeah.
And sometimes just breathing is a pushback. Oh, actually, not sometimes. Breathing is just a pushback. The fact that we're still here, that's our biggest flex, is that we're still here. You know, regardless of the poisoning of the, you know, of the flour, the shaking of the smallpox blankets, the spear, the kicking the kids' heads off, regardless of all the filth and the mayhem, we're still here. That is our biggest flex. We're still able to smile and stretch and yawn and scratch our asses as we walk along the day You haven't bothered me that much. You've done some horrible things, but I'm still here.
Wow.
Well, maybe a bit much. Though.
No, it's great. Well, Adi Shadu, thank you so much for coming on today and having this lovely chat with me.
Well, thank you for having us, Dylan. I really have enjoyed it. So I'm sure you're gonna post that GoFundMe little bits and pieces,
I'll put that in
and
there.
The thing for Lyra's dance thing, because it's gonna be fun. I'm gonna go just as many people. It's gonna be good fun, I think.
I already go every Monday, so I'll be there. Mm, yeah.
Cool.
Excellent. Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm.